We're pleased to welcome to our studio here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications one of the great performers of radio and television, Mr. Olin Soule. Olin, how nice of you to stop by today.
Oh, thank you, Chuck. How nice of you to invite me. My goodness, I'm delighted. I love Chicago, of course, having spent 14 wonderful years here, started radio here.
This was the very first place you started radio.
The very first, yeah. Did a $5 show up on the 11th floor Tribune Tower for Bowman Dairy, I think, called Uncle Quinn's Scalawags. And Uncle Quinn was Quinn Ryan, the manager of WGN, who paid us by personal check.
Personal check.
Which was interesting. Yeah. And, yeah, it was my first show. And I also worked on the roof of the Drake Hotel. They always used to say, WGN on the roof of the Drake Hotel. And they had a couple of studios up there. And it was really the Windy City up there, Chuck.
Boy, I bet it was.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that must have been a fairly high place at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe the Wrigley Building was there.
Yeah.
That was maybe in the Tribune Tower. Well, the Tribune Tower wouldn't have been there yet, would they?
What?
Would the Tribune Tower have been...
Oh, yes.
It was there.
But the Tribune Tower was there, but not the new studio building next door to it.
Oh, that's right.
It's connected to it. I think it's an office building or something now. But it was a beautiful audience studio where we used to do First Nighter when it was on WGN. And, of course, it went on to CBS. It was on there mostly. But... yeah, they had some great studios in there. And then, of course, I worked at WBBM a lot on First Nighter and Bachelor's Children.
How did you get started in radio? When did that bug bite you?
Well, in high school, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's what preceded it. I started on a tent show in 1926 when I was 17. And then I had 7 years on the stage, stock and rep. And in the beginning of the... We were married in 1929. And then in 19... I was on another show, tent show, and stock after that. But then in 1933, the stage business and jobs kind of fell apart. Mm-hmm. Beginning of the Depression, you know. They weren't making enough money to pay anything anymore. And I stopped in an agent's office in Chicago. I was going to say I could come up with his name. The Johnstone office, that's who it was. Uh-huh. And the best offer I could get was 2 a week stock in Zanesville, Ohio for $25 a week and furnish your own wardrobe. And so I said, well, we can be hungry here as well as there. And so I stayed in Chicago. And this was the days of the NRA, National Recovery Administration, when the government got businesses to hire people that they didn't need to do jobs that they created in order to have a few bucks, you know. And so for 6 months, I worked at the Edgar T. Ward Steel Company out in the South Side for $65 a month.
A month?
A month. Uh-huh. I was so good that I, before the 6 months was over, I got raised to $75 a month. And in the meantime, I was getting auditions, getting little $5 and $10 jobs, you see. I lied, of course, out of the Ward Steel Company. They didn't know I was an actor. Everybody in the family was sick or dying one time or another. And finally, the boss said, look, Soule, you've been gone more than you've been here. If you have to leave this time, just don't come back. So that was my entry into radio.
So you thought you'd rather do radio than work in the steel company.
Than work in the steel company, yeah. So that was 1933. And so I got started and became a pretty popular young leading man. I had some talent and a lot of luck, you know. And Blair Wallace, excuse me, Blair Walliser was the production chief at WGN then. I was through New York just a couple of days ago, as you know, and looked him up and tried to get him on the phone, but his phone was busy, 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 so I didn't get to talk to him. I had to leave. But at any rate, then the first... my first network radio show was Little Orphan Annie.
Out of Chicago here.
Out of Chicago, yeah. In which I played Daddy Warbuck's Chinese cook on the yacht. Didn't speak a word of English.
What was that, aha or ahi or...
Aha, aha, yeah. And,
aha.
Yeah, aha. And we used to fly around. A lot of us were real busy in those days. And I used to work in, I played Coach Hardy. I was a second Coach mm-hmm. Hardy in Jack Armstrong at the Wrigley Building, which was on at 3:30 and 4:30. And Orphan Annie was on the 19th floor of the Merchandise Mart at 3:45 and 4:45, immediately following. Everything live broadcast mm-hmm. then, as you know. So my wife used to, on the days that the two characters happened to be at the same time, she'd bring a cab down to the back door of the Wrigley Building. I'd run down those marble steps into the cab, over to the Merchandise Mart. The starter would, of course, know about it, shoot me up to the 19th floor, and I'd get in the door just as Pierre André, God bless him, would be droning out the last words of his lead-in, and Max Weisman would be up looking out the control room window, wondering if I was going to make it this time. I know he's made it, and ulcers to match.
What would have happened if you didn't make it? Someone else would have had to double?
Someone else would step in and read it. Yeah, we did that. We had things that happened when the bridge would be up, you know, you couldn't get back. And so things like that happen.
One of the great things about Chicago is the series of drawbridges here that that no other city has.
That's right. Sometimes you'd go down and get a little motorboat to take you over, you know.
And anything.
It was frozen over, then you're out of luck, you know. My first series then out of here was a wonderful show called Bachelor's Children, which was a real family show. Hugh Studebaker, Marge Hannon, Pat Dunlap, and me, Marie Nelson as Ellen, and the housekeeper, Dr. Bob's housekeeper, and later Helen Van Tile after Marie died. That was a great show, on for 11 solid years.
Well, and that was 5 days a week.
1935 to 1946, mm-hmm. 5 days a week, 15 minutes a day, two broadcasts a day. First one for the Midwest and East. Second one for the West Coast, you know, to
That's
give it
right.
a morning time.
Yeah.
We'd do it in the early afternoon here, and I'd get out there in the morning. And
it was the identical script, right?
Identical.
Identical.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. You would do the identical script. And then, of course, my first nighter program was probably my best-known one. That was co-starred with Barbara Luddy on that as the leading man on it for the last 10 years it was on.
It was Les Tremaine who started out on that.
No, Don Ameche.
Don Ameche.
Yeah.
And where did Les come in?
Don Ameche was there for 6 years,
yeah. mm-hmm.
from 1930 to 1936.
Mm-hmm.
Les came on with Barbara now. Mm-hmm. That's when Barbara mm-hmm. came on, in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there for 6 years, till 1942. Oh, okay. Then he left and went to do Thin Man in New York. They hired me opposite Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it from 1943 to 53, and they moved us to Hollywood in 1947. That's the way I got there.
The first nighter that brought you out to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Now, the first nighter program was from the Little Theater off Times Square.
Little Theater off Times
and
Square.
And the program never really did come from New York, did it?
Fictitious New York origination, always from here. Although there is a little theater next door to Sardi's there off Times Square.
It's called the Little Theater.
Called the Little Theater, yeah.
You were not the first nighter, nor was Les or
No, that's we're often called just because it fits with the show background.
Mm-hmm.
We're always called Mr. First Nighter,
mm-hmm.
and I've explained several times we had several different Mr. First Nighter. Brett Morrison
mm-hmm.
Was one of our prominent Mr. First Nighters. He did The Shadow, of course. Ed Prentice from Captain Midnight mm-hmm. was one of them. Hugh Douglas was one of them. Out on the coast. From Hollywood, Rye Billsbury,
mm-hmm.
Known now as Michael Rye, was Mr. First Nighter. And he's the guy who invited you into his cabin, brought you up Broadway to 42nd Street mm-hmm. and into the little theater.
And then someone else would say, "Good evening, Mr. First Nighter."
That's
and then
right.
he would say, "Let's take our seats. The curtain's about to rise."
And out in Hollywood, when we talk about it out there, they're always interested in hearing that the page boy was Gil Stratton, Jr., who is now a big CBS sports announcer.
He's a sportscaster, announcer.
Yeah, sure. He was the page boy out there.
Well, everybody gets started someplace.
Oh, yeah.
yeah.
And, of course, that was always an audience show.
Right.
And we always dressed for it
mm-hmm.
In Chicago.
And that was out of the Wrigley Building, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And always with evening gowns and tuxedos. We dressed for it beautifully. And when we were moving to the coast, I said, "Well, I'm going to have me a brand new tuxedo." Mm-hmm. I had... can't think of the tailor's name here now. But anyway, I had a beautiful new tuxedo made.
Mm-hmm.
Never had it on a show out there. We never dressed like that.
Didn't
in Hollywood.
Didn't dress out there in California?
No.
No kidding.
No. No, it was too... I hear you.
Yeah. Getting our photos taken.
Yeah.
It's amazing that so many people would want to see a radio show.
Yeah.
The radio show, actually, to watch a radio show, as fascinating as it might be from a technical point of view, you're seeing all the actors reading the scripts as
yeah.
opposed to... If
just
you're at home in front of the radio, you're enjoying the sound.
Sure.
But really, the number of people who ultimately went to radio shows and saw them is a small amount compared to the millions and millions
oh, yes.
Who listened in. You
know. Incidentally, it just occurred to me, one show that I worked in here was called Captain Midnight.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh. Ed Prentice was mm-hmm. Captain Midnight at that time when I was working in it. Then I did it on the coast in television. They auditioned two different casts, and our cast got it, Dick Webb, Sid Melton, mm-hmm. and me. And to this day, on the train coming in to New York, I was just into New York and back, going back now to the coast, and going both directions, guys in their, I don't know, early 40s, I guess, said, oh, I know you from Captain Midnight.
Oh, boy.
Isn't that nice?
Well, you know, you haven't changed
at all. Ms.
Warren,
our cameraman.
Yes, yes. You haven't changed at all.
How do you mean?
Over the years, physically, you look about as same as you always have. And
I don't really look 80?
No, I would not think you're 80. You are 80, aren't you?
I'm 80, yeah. This spring, uh-huh. we love to take cruises, mm-hmm. my wife and I, and... So this spring, we cheated the cruise company. We celebrated two events on one cruise ticket.
Oh, yeah.
Went in February and celebrated our 60th wedding anniversary and my 80th birthday.
My goodness.
So we got our money's worth.
Boy, oh, boy. Well, congratulations.
Yeah,
thank you. A little late, but that's wonderful.
Thank you.
See, and they say the Hollywood marriages don't last 60 years.
Huh? Yeah.
Of course, that's a Chicago marriage.
Of course,
it
started in Illinois.
That's right. Illinois.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My wife's home is in Belleville, Illinois, uh-huh. across from St. Uh-huh. Louis. And my home is in a little town of La Harpe, Illinois, down near Galesburg. Mm-hmm. And we're going to visit there about this train and stuff. We've just been on a trip up the East Coast, mm-hmm. a fall color tour in New England. And instead of flying in, we wanted to take the train. We love trains. So we came in from Hollywood, from Los Angeles, to New York by train. Then we took the tour... Now we're on our way back home, mm-hmm. but in the meantime, we're stopping off in Fort Madison, Iowa, and picking up a rental car so I can drive back to La Harpe and visit the house where I was born, take pictures of it in
nice.
Case anybody wants to make a shrine of it someday.
Well, 'cause possible. It's possible.
Yeah.
You really have had a fantastic career, and we're just talking about radio, but you... made a very easy transition to television, didn't you? I mean, anybody...
That's right. That's
you talk
right.
about the Captain Midnight shows, which in reruns were called Jet Jackson.
Jet Jackson, yeah.
And you were kind of a scientist.
I was Tut the scientist on there.
Yeah.
Anthony Jones, also known as Tut.
But you couldn't hardly watch a Dragnet TV show without seeing you turn
that's
up
right.
in one of those.
Yeah,
things.
I always played Ray Pinker in the crime lab mm-hmm. in Dragnet in the series and also in the features.
Yeah.
And, I started easily in pictures. Pictures came mm-hmm. first, of course, mm-hmm. out there. We moved out there in 47, and my first picture was with Ronnie Reagan at Warner Brothers, a girl from Jones Beach with Virginia Mayo, mm-hmm. and not on camera. I was a radio announcer. What else?
Typecasting.
Yeah, yeah. But if you came out there as a leading man of a show, if you had a job, you must be good, so they'd hire you then, you know.
Well, really, I would think the movies fit very well with the radio acting because much of the radio work was in the evening, perhaps, if you were on the major shows, and you were with First Nighter and other things.
And I had mm-hmm. to keep my couple of days a week clear for First Nighter, mm-hmm. so I couldn't get tied up in anything on pictures that was going to run too long because I had to be mm-hmm. available for my bread and butter, you know.
Right.
And so I became primarily what's known as a day player, although I had contract things too, like Captain Midnight. But I kept busy. Picture to picture to picture to picture, and then television came along. And my old-time picture agent, when he'd call up, would always apologize, and he'd say, Olin, it's only television. And I'd say, George, you don't know, television might become famous sometime. Might become worthwhile.
Could be. Huh?
And it kind of did. Yeah.
Unfortunately, we lost a little of the radio with television coming in so strongly.
Yeah, that's right. But well, people still love the radio programs. Oh, yeah. Boy, they get a hold of the tapes. And of course, there were no tapes at the time that we did them, as you know. The only way you got them was if a station did a DB, a delayed broadcast, and put them on a 16-inch acetate. And then those records, some of them got kept, and others would get tossed in the corner and thrown away. And sometimes you'd find, as you know, a pile of them in the corner of an old dark closet in the advertising agency or someplace. Right. And then people would pull them out as they got interested in them and start taping them. Yeah. And that's where we got the few tapes that we have now.
Well, your performances on the radio were wonderful.
Thank you.
On the First Nighter program and on the Grand Marquis, you did some of those things. It was kind of like a stock company, and you were always the leading man.
Yeah.
And every week you were a different person. But it was always usually a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And you worked for many years with Barbara Luddy.
Oh, yeah. I was with Barbara for 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's gone now.
She was a very nice person. And she
she was a very
talented actress.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah. So on Grand Marquis, my leading lady on there most of the time was Vaughn. Can't get her
Burl
name
Burl Vaughn?
Burl Vaughn. Yeah, Burl Vaughn. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you ran across a card there a while ago of another leading lady that I had on there a couple of times, but Burl did most of them.
Mm-hmm. Muriel.
Muriel Bremner.
Muriel
Bremner.
We were looking through the files here at the museum to see all the different things.
I get to that point where it's hard to remember all those names from that long
you're doing
ago.
You're doing a wonderful job. Now, in addition to radio and television and the movies, you have a whole second career going, I guess, or a third or fourth career going, doing commercials.
You've
done voiceovers for television, you've done radio commercials.
Here's a count. I did, in the 40 years there in Hollywood, I'm supposed to be retired now, but in the 40 active years in Hollywood, I worked in over 200 different TV series, 60 movies, and 300 commercials, evenly mixed between voiceover and on camera. I was known more for my voiceovers, because at one time I was one of the half dozen busiest voiceover guys out there, and of course not anymore. The young voices have taken over, you know.
Are you doing much at all these days? Or are you just really taking it easy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have really celebrated retirement 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But since then, and I don't look for work anymore. I don't go up for interviews or auditions or anything of that kind. And, of course, the new young casting directors say, what's an Olin Soule? But the old-timers, of course, remember me. But a couple of years ago, I was invited up to do a Bob Hope show.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that 3 years ago, it was. I did that, of course, because I had a good comedy scene with Bob. And it was fun. Also a good salary. Mm-hmm. And so that was fun to do. And then last year I did my third Simon and Simon. Because on there, John Stevens, the executive producer, is an old friend from back at Don Federson's My Three Sons days, when we used to work together there. And so he likes to call me in. And if his casting director says, what's an Olin Soule? He says, never mind, just call him.
Well, it's nice to see you pop up every once in a while on these things.
It's fun for me, too.
Now, you are quite active in the Pacific Pioneer broadcast.
Yeah, right.
Out in on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And a group of us are planning to
come visit
you folks pretty soon. And I know you're going to be there for the luncheon meeting, but you won't be there when we do some interview taping.
Yeah.
And you were so kind to give me a call and say, Chuck, I'm going to be in Chicago for a couple of hours between trains, and I'd love to see the museum. I've heard so much about it, and I'd like to, if you want to sit down and talk on tape, let's do it. So
this
is
my chance.
Pleased that you
I didn't want
to
get cheated out of it.
No, that's great.
I knew I'd miss you out there when you're doing the interviews out there, so I thought, well, here's the chance if he's got the time.
You're really, really among so many people out there in the PPB, the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters. There's you and so many others are. have roots in Chicago.
That's right. Yeah.
A great many people from Chicago are out there now and did so much work here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you all left because you were only getting $3 a show or something out here at the time.
Well, After had come along, and we were in better shape. Mm-hmm. And then if you became a star of a show, of course, you got better money. Not a lot of money. I got, on First Nighter, I got $350, which mm-hmm. was a good salary then.
Mm-hmm.
Now it wouldn't be, of course. But, let me think. Lost my train of thought.
Talking about salaries and fees.
Out there. Sorry.
That's okay. AFTRA, really, the Actors Union, the Performers Union for radio, AFRA at first and AFTRA later, they're the ones who really kept the performers from starving because the producers would be very content to pay $2 or $3
for a
15-minute show or something.
Like $5 I got for my first one.
Yeah, yeah. But now things have changed and... all those former Chicagoans are gathered around the luncheon table at the Sportsman's Lodge about every couple of months out there during the fall and the winter season.
Yeah.
Well, we're looking forward to coming out there. And
I wish I could think of what I was trying to say a while ago, because it might have been important.
Well, you can drop me a note.
Yeah. Yeah, might do that, too. Yeah.
You've had a great career, and on behalf of all the folks who listen to this show and enjoy some of your performances from time to time, people who see you on television, I want to say thanks, Olin. You did a marvelous job, and you're such a great guy.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the career. It was good to me, and I've enjoyed being here. And I have a niece and her husband, Betty and Don Goss, out in Northbrook, who I dropped them a note and said I was going to stop here and do an interview with you, and they say they listen to you all the time and love your show.
Oh, well, that's so nice.
So I thought I should say hello to them.
Well, you just did. That's real great. Thanks very much for being... Oh, before you go, I have to ask you one thing. Now, everybody says, today, the young people say, what is an Olin Soule? What kind of is that a French name, or...?
It's a French name. Mm-hmm. Soule is a French name.
S-O-U-L-E with that...
accent, right? The Olin is nothing. The way I got named, at the time I was born, my mother and father were worthy matron and worthy patron of the Order of the Eastern Star.
Mm-hmm.
So they named me Olin Everett Soule, so my initials would be O-E-S, standing for Order of the Eastern Star.
Mm-hmm.
And the name... while it's a French name, it's English ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
There was, on the Mayflower, there was a relative, George Soule, or George Soule, as it was pronounced then.
Mm.
He was a passenger on the Mayflower, a signer of the compact. His grandson, Benjamin, married Miles Standish's granddaughter, Sarah, and our branch of the family comes down directly from that. And I'm 9 generations removed from George. And I belong to the Society of Mayflower Descendants and so on. So George was really English, although they haven't been able to trace him much over in England. I don't know. Maybe he had to leave England.
Maybe he eradicated all the records over there before he left.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad he did, because 9 generations later, I guess, we got you.
Yeah.
And that's wonderful. Thanks very much for being with
us. Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you, Chuck. You're sure welcome.